save big money, and start your spring project with help from Menards. We offer a huge selection of Bonnie plants, veggies, and herbs to plant at home and grow yourself. Right now, all 4.5-inch Bonnie plants are on sale through May 18th. Head to the Menards Garden Center to get your garden growing and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, it's Adam from Counting Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song on Consequence.
Welcome, listeners, to The Story Behind the Song. I'm your host, Peter Chotti of Deep Cuts Media. Counting Crows is a band that took flight in the early 1990s with a dose of Laurel Canyon, California vibes amidst a music scene that was beginning to tire of grunge. Lead singer and songwriter Adam Duritz piloted the band, which skyrocketed into instant fame with the release of their debut mega album, August and Everything After, in 1993. That immediate success took a toll on Duritz, who regrouped in 1996 to craft their second album, Recovering the Satellites, with a more raw, less polished sound. But although the band's second album was edgier, Duritz's moving melody-making continued and escalated with his deeply emotional and moving song, A Long December, which has become a kind of holiday classic now decades later. Even Duritz didn't realize the impact of this song until recently, when he played a benefit concert with other leading artists who sang along with shared nostalgia. I interview him about it all in this week's The Story Behind the Song. It's a fascinating discussion with Duritz opening up to share his triumphs and his challenges as the band prepares to hit the road on their summer tour and in support of their great new album, Butter Miracle, The Complete Sweets. So take a listen as we dive deep into the story behind the Crows' most iconic song, A Long December, with singer-songwriter Adam Duritz. Counting Crows, seminal band, over 20 million records sold. You guys were particularly near and dear to me from the very beginning. I lived in Laurel Canyon at the time. And so Long December and your first album, August and Everything After, these were like, the soundtrack to my girlfriends and I, and then ultimately we got married and we're still married today. But soundtrack to our lives in Laurel Canyon. So, Adam, great to have you here. And so before we get into the song and then into your new album, I always like getting a little bit of a journey of your life, of becoming a musician, and how that happened, and when you really first started to take music seriously, and then leading up to the formation of the band.
I started to take it seriously when I started writing songs. And that happened really in earnest when I was a freshman in college. Fall term of my freshman year, there was a lounge across from my dorm room, and there was a piano in the lounge. And I was in class one day, and I started kind of writing down pieces of a song. I went back to the dorm and worked on it. It suddenly occurred to me I had this thing in my head. I had a lot of the lyrics. I kind of had a tune. I wondered if I could sit down at the piano and figure out how to play it. It's very, very simple. It would take me 5 minutes now, but it took me all the rest of the afternoon. I missed the rest of my classes. I just sat in that lounge and worked on the song all day and finished it. It was like a light bulb moment in a cartoon. I mean, I just changed right then and there. I was a songwriter. You know, part of being young in those college years is that sense of transition from a life where everything is assigned to you, and then you're in college and you still have things assigned to you, you got classes and stuff, but you're starting to look towards a life when you decide what you are. It's a scary moment, you know. What is it being adult? What is being an adult all about? You know, you have no sense of who you're going to be, and you're trying to find that, and it takes years and years for most people. For me, it took an afternoon. It just happened. I wrote that song and I was a songwriter. It was just done. That's who I was. That's what I did. I wrote songs. And at that moment, I mean, it had changed my entire life from that moment on. I never really thought of myself as anything else ever again from, I don't know when that was, like September or October of my 18th year.
Prior to that, you didn't write songs before that moment, that seminal moment where you got the spark and that overtook you. But were you playing a musical instrument or anything before that time?
I had played a little piano. I'd been in a band when I was younger. Played bass in the band and sang. But I hadn't in a while. I mean, music's a weird thing. You can, unless you are a really good musician, which I'm not, as far as an instrumentalist, I'm really good at being a singer and an arranger. I'm really good as an arranger, although I wasn't then. Now, I'm actually a really good tambourine player, which is strange. I've worked on that over the years.
Yeah.
Because it's a very hard instrument to play. But, you know, up till that point, I was a huge music fan. I loved music. I was obsessed with music. I listened to music and read about music and thought about music all the time. But it wasn't something I saw as a life because I didn't know what I was going to do with it. You know, like, I didn't have any real investment that way. I've never been a great player. I'm still not a very good piano player. I think I developed piano playing to write. And it was a struggle, and it is a struggle. Very difficult for me because I can't really play by ear at all. So I just, you know, I figure it out.
Did you record that first song that you wrote?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I did. I'm sure.
Is there any place to find it?
Not that I'm telling anybody. I mean, I'm pretty sure I have it.
That'd be a cool thing.
It's a developmental thing, you know. I was intensely proud of that song. You know, and everything I wrote after that, each one of them was the absolute best I could do right then. But I wouldn't put them out. You know, I mean, they're part of me learning to be truthful, learning to be honest, learning to be emotionally bare, you know, learning to, you know, they're all this learning process until really Himalayans and Counting Crows.
So from that time, the dorm, having that magical moment with the piano, what was the journey like to get to, you mentioned Himalayas, and then getting to Counting Crows and starting the band?
For a couple of years, I just wrote and wrote and wrote, like every day. I just wrote songs for really a couple of years after that. Mm-hmm. I transferred from Davis down to Berkeley. I was an English major. I had been a women's studies major, but I had kind of gone through all the courses at Davis. And I became an English major because the women's studies stuff was so writing intensive that I wanted to be a better writer. And also I was writing songs, so.
Yeah.
And the English department at Berkeley was the best in the country back then. I think it was Berkeley and Yale were the two best, like, writing departments there were. So I transferred down to Berkeley and all, for that reason, and also because if I really wanted to do something with all these songs, I needed to be out of Davis. The bands in Davis were, you know, mostly playing frat parties, cover bands. And I didn't have any interest in doing that. I didn't join any. Yeah. Like, I didn't really want to. I just wanted to try and be a real musician. I moved down to Berkeley, got a job in a recording studio as like an assistant engineer. Did my first recordings really there. I was engineering a session, by which I mean pushing a button or two, for the guy that ran the studio, and he had a song, and I was sort of sitting in the booth humming it to myself as they were playing it. It was instrumental with his band and writing lyrics. And I, you know, when he came in one point, I'm like, hey, you know, I got some lyrics for this. And he's like, oh, I'll try it. And I went in the studio, and I mean, he loved it. So I did some recording with him, and he let me record a few other things. I got in a band or two, played in a few that lasted a few years, got kind of disillusioned. Doing art is really, really hard, and especially in a collaborative art form, for different reasons than just stuff you do yourself. You know, it's, you start them with your friends, it's a big democracy, everybody's like, yay, and then you fight over things because everybody cares. The friendships that you started with get kind of frayed because of that. It's just real life. It's the difference between a hobby and a life, is that you hear people talk about something they're working on and they say, well, it stopped being fun and I didn't want to do it anymore. I understand why people say that, but that's the difference between someone who has a hobby, which is for fun, and someone who wants to do something with their life, which is not for fun. It can be fun, but it's for more than that. In my first band, my first real band, I just didn't get over that hump, and I quit, went over to Europe backpacking with some friends, did that kind of trip, you know, to stop playing music and draw a line and get on with my life. While I was over there, my friend David Immergluck, who's one of our guitar players now, he had joined Camper Van Beethoven, and they were out on tour opening for 10,000 maniacs in front of like 20,000 people a night. And I was just so fucking jealous that I started writing songs again off the top of my head in Europe. And then I went home like a little while after that. I was like, I got to just go back to work. And I started a band that kind of became an early version of Counting Crows then. When that sort of fell apart, I joined Himalayans. And that was a really good band. And we were doing really well. Round Here is a Himalayan song, actually. Yeah, I mean, we covered it. I went back to playing some shows with Dave Bryson, just like open mics and stuff, yeah. And some acoustic sets. We were covering Round Here. And I started writing more stuff. You know, like, Himalayans was really, it was one of those We're a Democracy bands. I didn't write any music. I mostly just, like, I sang and I wrote the lyrics and I loved it. It was like way less responsibility. I wasn't the band leader. I was just one of the guys. And it was a much louder, more experimental band in a lot of ways. But while I was in it and enjoying being in a band again, I was writing some material that didn't really feel right for Himalayans. I'd gone back to writing some songs again. And I tried some of them out when me and Dave Bryson were playing like open mic stuff. I just started to feel like maybe I was ready to try, you know, leading a band again. I didn't want to leave Himalayans. I loved it, you know. But yeah. I was in like three bands then. I was in a lot of different bands at that point. I sang backgrounds for Sordid Humor. I was the lead singer in Himalayans. And I started to think a little more seriously about this, you know, Counting Crows thing me and Dave were doing. And we got together some of our favorite musicians a few different times just to do some recording sessions at Dave's studio because he had a little indie, like, 16-track studio, Dancing Dog. And over the course of those years while I was in Himalayans, we did like two or three different groups of sessions with kind of Counting Crows versions of it, you know. Mm-hmm. And the last one, it turned out really, really well. That was basically the band that was the first version of Counting, you know, the first record, you know. And those recordings we made got to some record people and everybody went crazy.
Yeah.
And that's kind of they were demos that we'd done, but there were 15 songs on the demo tape, including Mr. Jones, Rain King, A Murder of One, Einstein on the Beach, Around Here, Omaha, Anna Begins, and then a bunch of other songs that I had that were really good songs. Well, they weren't really good songs, but they were really catchy songs. And Dave did a really good job of producing them. We had songs, and that was clear on that first demo, because most bands have a song, and we had 15, you know, like, yeah, it was like a bidding war in that, in Counting Crows. Voila.
Yeah, I mean, that's the amazing thing. It's like, you were in several bands, so it's not like it was overnight. You were honing your craft, you were doing all this, but from the time that you sent your demo out, there was a bidding war, and it was a time where, I don't know what you thought about it, but, or if it even entered your head at the time, but that was certainly in the pop culture, the attention was going for grunge at the time, and there was a lot of that. That was in the zeitgeist of popular culture at the time. And obviously, Counting Crows is coming in with a very different sound at that point.
When we were making it, grunge wasn't a big deal. Just Nirvana. I mean, those bands were out there, but none of them were big. The only one that had blown up was Nirvana. I mean, I knew who Soundgarden was, you know, but they weren't any big deal. It was only Nirvana. That was the only band that had blown up out of that scene when we were making the record, I believe. By the time it came out, Pearl Jam was out too. And then after that, it's like everything's grunge. So by the time we get into the popular country, that's true. But not while we were making it, really. You know, and anyways, you don't really think about it at the time because you're not experiencing the popular culture the same way everyone else is. By that time, you're in a van. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? You're literally in a van. And you're driving from city to city, it's exhausting, and you're playing shows, and you're in those shows every night. I was really cognizant of, like, American indie rock, or just indie rock in general. We thought of ourselves as indie rock. I mean, we weren't coming from the mainstream. We were on a label that was all indie rock. I mean, it was like the Posies, the Sundays, Sonic Youth, Nirvana, and us. You know, like, I mean, it was, oh, and Teenage Fan Club, you know, like, that was DGC Records back then.
Pretty great bands.
So, yeah, I mean, and there's more than that too. There's Maria McKee, also Peter Gabriel and Ricky Lee Jones, but, you know, there was very much like, we were all kind of college radio. The only people that weren't were Nirvana, who had blown up by that time, but they had been college radio too. So, I mean, we kind of all thought of ourselves the same. I mean, I don't think we thought of ourselves as different. We were just all indie rock bands. You know, like, if there was someone who I probably identified with that way, it would have been REM. But REM spent 5 albums and almost 10 years as an indie band on IRS. And that felt like where we were all coming from. Because even though DGC was part of a major label, it felt like an indie label. We had real clear conversations with everybody talking about how we just wanted to get on 120 minutes. Alternative rock stations, but really college radio stations, and hopefully we would sell 100,000 records maybe. That would be great. That was the dream from people at Geffen, from executives, you know, like, yeah. And we had a three album deal. So the hope was that we would like have time to build it, you know, like REM, that was the model. You mostly didn't, people didn't blow up like Nirvana did. It was a surprise. None of the other bands on Geffen, on DGC certainly were blowing up like that. So we really didn't think of it that way. Like to us, we were just a college radio band. We were opening for Suede early on. Mm-hmm. And we were opening for Cracker, which to me was just Camper Van Beethoven.
Yeah.
With a few different members. You know, it was still David Lowery, who had been my idol as a kid. Not as a kid, but as a young musician. And, you know, Monks of Doom, the other spin-off band from Camper Van Beethoven, used to rehearse in my dad's basement. You know, so for me, it was just like we were in the indie scene we had just come out of in San Francisco. We were still, you know, Suede was big in England maybe, but it was a, you know, they were a cool indie band in America, and that's sort of just how we thought of ourselves, and that's the way it was until it wasn't, like, which caught us all by surprise.
So when it's not what you had expected it to be, and all of a sudden you have this massive success with Counting Crows and the first album in 1993 and Mr. Jones and all the wonderful songs that are on that, how does a young guy like you deal with that immediate massive success? Like, what is that like when you don't have those kind of expectations? Nobody can prepare for that.
Well, I slipped comfortably into a nice mental health breakdown. It's a very big change in your life to go from being aggressively anonymous to the cover of Rolling Stone and recognizable everywhere you go. I had a very recognizable look too. It's not something you think of because it's just how you look. I could be recognized anywhere I was after the cover of Rolling Stone, for sure. It's just life after rock. It's, you know, I've said the same thing a million times, but if you woke up on Mars, it would take you a while to get used to the gravity, but you
right.
would, but it
right.
would take a while. And it took me a while, but it's still an adjustment. It's just not like anything else. I wasn't expecting it to though, but that, you know, you could have all the intentions in the world. Life is a road that you don't necessarily set that path for yourself. It goes where it goes.
Right.
You make your choices, you know, and that was my choice. When I felt differently, I went back to it. There's only one rule for being an artist, which is to make. There's no other good advice I could give anyone. You know, how to deal with record companies, how to deal with fame, how to deal with how to make yourself successful. I have no idea on any of that. But an artist makes. An artist makes art. And then the chips fall where they may. You know, like, I mean, planning for fame is important. You know, I mean, I guess at a certain level and a certain kind of pop thing, there are some very cunning plans you could maybe make to do things, you know, and there are very smart people like Madonna who, you know, obviously put a lot of thought into being a cultural phenomenon as well and how to promote herself. And that's great. I don't have really mind for that myself. The only thing I could really say to any artist if they wanted advice from me is just to make art. The rest of it is nobody knows really what makes success. The only thing people at a record company know is, from my experience, is what was good last time. But do you really want to spend your life based on last time as opposed to next time? You know what I mean? Like, it's not really, that's not much use. You can do that, but that's like chasing yourself down a hole. All you ever get is something you already did.
Yeah.
Which is mostly what people want to hear, but not if it's tired. You know, I didn't think we were doing anything particularly groundbreaking. I just thought it was great. I just thought it was really true and honest and like deeply, deeply heartfelt. And it was stuff we were really passionate about, and it was as good as we could do. That was one thing I was sure of. We did it as good as we could do it. And then we got better and did it again, and that was as good as we could do it. And I don't know if it's better or worse than anything else. That's other people obsess over that. What I did know is that we were doing the best we could do, and we were always doing it on our terms. Like, we were never trying to chase it down the hole of last time. You know, when we made that second record, everyone wanted us to work with T-Bone again. You know, what they wanted was After August and Everything After, you know.
Exactly.
You know, and we weren't interested. We had other interests. We knew the band was different then. We were playing louder music. We had a lead guitar player then and a different drummer. And we just wanted to play this music that was so different from some of it. Some of it was very similar to the stuff on August, but a lot of it was really different. It was much more raw. You know, and we wanted to work with Gil Norton, who had made the Pixies records that I was obsessed with right then, you know, and also the Laws records that I loved. It seemed so great, but it wasn't what the record company wanted, which wasn't a big deal. They didn't really fight us. We had creative control, but all the advice kind of went in the other direction. But we never did that. We always kind of did what we wanted to do, and it's up to other people to decide whether it's good or bad. but I always loved it. Otherwise, why put it out? I mean, get it to the point where you absolutely love it and then release it. And if it's not where you absolutely love it, don't fucking put it out.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, and you were talking about the record label wanted to have August and everything after. And that, but Recovering the Satellites comes out in 96 and it immediately hits number one. But I want to, like, going into the studio the second time, you described what you were going for and different production and, you know, different producer this time and all that. How was your feeling as a musician at that time going into the studio different than the first time? Like, what was your mindset like at that point?
Well, the first time I was very, very nervous and I had no idea what I was doing. All I knew was that we had to completely change the band. You know, we sounded a little, before we recorded the first album, we sounded a little like late era Roxy music. Avalon era Roxy music is kind of where we were sonically, and I thought that was, don't get me wrong, I loved Roxy music, but it felt very beholden to a time. A lot of the musicians in the band were very influenced by stuff they'd heard, and they were thinking about good stuff. It's very hard to shrug off the idea of your influences at times, and it's it's easy to define good as like that thing I just heard. You know what I mean? Because that was good and successful. And a lot of the people in the band were very tied down to that in some ways, myself included. You know, we had all come from a scene. Maybe you really loved Stone Roses. That stuff was groundbreaking. And that guitar player was so, you know, groundbreaking, and that you wanted to play like him. And so you used a lot of echoes and, you know, reverb. And your guitar playing sounded like Stone Roses, you know? Or maybe you liked Tony played with Peter Gabriel and he played a stick, you know? And so you were playing fretless bass, you know? There was just like stuff, you know, maybe you loved Stort Copeland and so you drummed like that, you know? That's great drumming. But those are all things you're doing to hear yourself, and we needed to listen to each other. You know, and in order to make a great record, I thought we had to learn to be a band. We hadn't been a band for very long, under 6 months when we got signed, you know, like it was pretty quick. So I wanted everybody to get rid of everything, all the effects, a lot of the drums on the drum kit, no more fretless bass for a little bit, get an old Hofner and a Vox, and let's just sit in a circle and play and hear each other and just become a band. And a lot of making the first album was stripped back. And there's all these people that like attributed that to some sort of like worship of 60s and 70s music, you know, like that very Laurel Canyon thing that like we wanted to be the band. Right. And in ways that's kind of true, but it was only because to me, the band were clearly listening to each other when they played. There was so much minutia of reaction between the different musicians, so many ways in which a vocal was influenced by a flick of the drums, you know, and it wasn't to be like those bands at all or to be like Van Morrison. It was just to learn to be a band. And I didn't know if any of that was going to work, but I wanted us to try it. And T-Bone agreed with me. And so, you know, that was all I knew going into making the first album, was just like that we weren't where we needed to be as a band. And we had to somehow get there in the middle of making our first record. And you know, hope it works. And then we tried, you know, and it did. Yeah. It worked, you know, in a way. I still think it's the slickest of the records in a way, but it's great. It's a great record. Then I had a really hard time being famous and flipped out and really went to move to LA and just completely forget about being in the band for a little while. And then I found myself ready and I was really excited because we had just spent a year and a half on tour or almost two years on tour. And we were a great band. And I wanted to get in the studio and play these songs and blow people's minds. And it was a completely different mindset going into the second record because I knew what I wanted to do. You know, one of the problems is when you write a song about how much you're struggling as a rock star, everybody gets really mad at you. But the fact is, it's true. It's real life, and that's where I was. So, you know, I had to write about what I was living through. And I did. I don't have any apologies about that. Fuck those people. Like, you can criticize the level of the music, but don't criticize the plot line because that's just life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I find that so stupid. But it is a lot of people's jealousy and frustrations that is expressed that way. But like, fact is, that's what I went through. I know everybody wants to be famous, but they have no idea what it is. And I went through it and I struggled and I had a really fucking hard time. And then I wrote a bunch of really cool songs about it. And we went and fucking blazed in the studio and made this great record, you know, and I was hugely excited. Very different going into the second album. I was driven and thrilled, and I was very, very hungry to make that record.
And it sounds like you didn't feel pressure because you were in this kind of damn the torpedoes mindset, right?
I've never felt pressure making a record, even the first one. I mean, because it's just you're doing your thing. You're expressing yourself, and not that it's not hard. It's really hard making records. But not because of outside pressure, because while you're in there, who even thinks the world exists? I mean, you've wanted all your life to write songs and be in a rock band, and now you're in a house. Your entire life is recording the songs that you wrote. I mean, you want to know pressure is being like in your mid-20s, having no idea how you're going to take care of yourself, how you're going to support yourself.
True,
you want
that.
To be a musician, but no one's even heard of you. How are you going to rise out of complete anonymity? You know, like, man, that's pressure. Like, in my mid-20s, when all my prospects were wound up in songwriting, when I had a mental health, serious mental illness problem, the only thing I was really good at was writing songs and singing. And I'm washing dishes or doing construction and doing landscaping to support myself. That's pressure. Like, I got a record deal and I can make a record. I didn't have room to think about, like, what is everyone going to think? I was sure they would love it. I was sure it was the best thing anyone could ever possibly do. It was definitely the best thing I could do. I was just thrilled. It's fucking magic making a record. It's really, really hard, but it's magic. I mean, you've spent your entire life obsessed with music, listening to music, to however many CDs and albums you have. It's all you've ever loved is music, you know? And now you're the one putting stuff on tape. You know what I mean? It's your music, and people are listening to your records. It's fucking magic. It's like Wonderland. You know, I mean, I lived in L.A. and Laurel Canyon in the, I don't know what you want to call it, the heartland, the where it comes from in a lot of ways, you know, like where a lot of people made music. Right around the corner from where Joni lived.
Yeah. So before we get into the new album, I want to dig in a little bit about A Long December. And if you remember the first spark of when that song came to you, like where you were, do you recall that moment where, whether it was the lyric or whether it was the music itself?
I was working at the Viper Room then. I was bartending and I got off work around 2 or something and drove up. My friend Samantha Mathis and Tracy Falco lived in a house right at the bottom of Laurel Canyon on Hillside. And like a block
down on Hillside,
a block east of Laurel Canyon and or Crescent Heights at that point. I went to their house for a while. I was hanging out with them for a couple hours, and I went back up to my place about 4 in the morning. I think I was tired, but I sat down at the piano in my living room and I started playing, and it just came right out, the whole song. I sat there for an hour or two and wrote it. It seemed to write itself. I felt like I knew where the chords were supposed to go in a way that I rarely do. It just felt like I knew where it should all go. I didn't have to think of a melody. It was there, you know, and I wrote it. It was all written in a couple hours. It was completely recorded in under 24. It was completely written and recorded in under 24 because I wrote it that night, finished around 5 or 6 in the morning. Got up the next day, called my A&R guy, Tony Berg, who produces all the Phoebe Bridgers records, you know. I called Tony and said, hey, man, I got to come down and play you something. He had a piano in his office. And I drove down to his office and sat there, played him the song. And then I went to the hospital for a little while. A friend of mine had been hit by a car, so I was spending a lot of the early parts of my days in the hospital at, I can't remember if she's in UCLA or something. She was in UCLA, I think.
There you go. There's that lyric.
Yeah. So I spent a lot of my days there, and about 4 or 5, I headed up to the studio. It was like Beechwood Canyon area. We had a house there. And I taught it to the guys before dinner, and we recorded it after dinner, and that version is like take 6, maybe. There are almost no overdubs on it. The only overdubs on the song are, is we played it, we realized we nailed it, everybody got up, we listened to it, everyone was great, went into the kitchen to get a drink. I grabbed the engineer and said, hey, just run me 2 more passes through it, and I sang the 2 background vocals, and that's it. That song was done. I remember going back to the Viper Room a couple hours later and playing it for the guys outside the, in my car, outside the door after we closed. So the whole thing was written and recorded in under 24 hours. It's a weird song. It was like perfect from birth, kind of. Like it just felt like it was easy to write and just very... this very natural progression. Like I knew what to say, I knew where to go on the piano, it came right out. It's the only song I never get tired of.
Interesting.
There's no other song that I want to play every night, every show, that I don't care. Maybe Holiday in Spain, but not really. Long December, I'm never tired of it. I'm always happy to play it. Like, it doesn't matter what the situation is. And that's not true of anything else. I get tired of everything. No matter how good the song is, you get tired of it at some point. But it never happens with that song. It just is, there's an inevitability to it that is, and a perfection to me. It is like, it's kind of gem-like to me in that it's just this perfectly crafted thing that's also very moving and emotional. It has that combination of things like, the classic songwriting has, like something like Try a Little Tenderness or Every Time You Say Goodbye, I Die a Little, they're like perfect songs, and it's just got this thing to it where it just always feels effortless and inevitable and perfect. I don't know.
It is a perfect song. That's why I wanted to talk about it. And, as I told you, it's so personal to me because we lived a block apart, at the time.
Yeah. Do you know Jesse Malin? I just realized I'm wearing a shirt.
Yeah.
You know who he is?
Not deeply. Yeah. But yeah.
He's a good friend of mine. Great musician. Like, truly great musician. I've known him for 20 years. And he had an accident a few years ago where he kind of had a stroke. And he lost all feeling below his waist out of nowhere. One of the most active, cool punk guys I know. And he just lost, half his body. And he's been down in Argentina for a couple years, I think, getting stem cell treatments, trying to working really hard to get it back. And he's gotten, down to mid thigh. And we made a tribute album for him last year. And in January or December, and I can't remember when it was, there was a couple of tribute concerts at Beacon Theater in New York. And a bunch of different people were going to play our songs from the tribute album, and Jesse was playing. It was incredibly inspirational. And I did this really great song of his, a couple of us, well, our band, did Oshina. And I loved that song, and I was really excited to play it. And the week before the show, Immer informed, because Immer plays in his band too, Immer informed me that we weren't going to be playing Oshina because Jesse wanted to play it. But Jesse wanted me to play Long December with the band, with his band and Immer. And I was really bummed at first because I feel like, this is Jesse's first real public show back in years. And everybody else is going to be playing his songs. And I'm going to be the one asshole who's not. Like, I felt like such a, like, I felt like an asshole. And I thought people were going to be really think it was because I'm an egomaniac or something. And then Emmer said, no, no. Well, one, Jesse really wants to play Oshina. But two, Long December is his favorite song. And he really wants you to play it. And I was like, okay, fine. But I was really nervous because I felt very self-conscious about going up on stage during this tribute to Jesse, you know, and not playing one of his songs.
Yeah.
And when I got up on stage to play it, it was near the end of the show. It was like two or three songs from the end of the show. Went out there to play it. I was so nervous that when I went to the rehearsals with his band, I couldn't fucking remember the words to my own song. I like blanked out on the third verse twice. The first half of the third verse, I just completely blanked out on it. It was really embarrassing. And when I went out to play it, though, I was still feeling really self-conscious because it had been a very, very moving night, but really based around Jesse. And then I started playing Long December, and it was so galvanizing, like with the audience too. I mean, you could feel it. It was like this deeply emotional, like, release from the audience where there'd been all this, I don't want to say tension because people were really celebrating, but it was, you know, Jesse, still hard for him to stand, you know, and he was amazing. But there's all this emotion in that night that was like tied up in, you know, this tragedy of what happened to him and his struggles, you know, to surmount that and how powerful it all was. And somehow during Long December, it's like it all released. And like, you know, in recent years, it's become this almost like Christmas tune, you know, like people play it in their concerts. Yeah. It means a lot to a lot of people, which it takes that a while to trickle down to me because I don't really, it's hard for me to grasp that, but it does mean a lot to a lot of people. But I don't think I ever really powerfully grasped that until the show when I was playing it. And as the entire audience seemed to like sob and release this, like, I don't know, fucking joy and all the feelings that have been pent up just like came out, and everyone is singing, and it was fucking crazy, you know. And yeah, and the song has that in it, you know. I know that, but I don't think I ever quite grasped how important it is to so many people until that night, which is, you know, 30 years into a career before it gets through my dense fucking head. But you know, there it was. Like,
that's beautiful, though. That's a beautiful story. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. That's very, very cool. Very, very cool. I want to make sure that we talk about your new album, Butter Miracle, that's coming out. And Butter Miracle, The Complete Sweets, which is an interesting name for an album. And I got to ask just really quickly how that happened, but I want to understand a little bit about how if at all, you think your songwriting process has changed from what we were just talking about back in 1993, 1996, and you've had several albums in between, but how you think you've evolved during that time. But I got to ask you about the name of the album first.
Well, Butter Miracle is bizarre and wonderful. And it's based on something. I like that it's kind of nonsense, even if it is based on something to me. So I can't tell you what it means because I don't want to.
I love that. Yes.
But, you know, the first thing that we did for it was a sweet one. And I decided I would call this half, which is not a sweet tooth. Because I think everyone was all on me about, when are you going to do the second suite? And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to do another suite ever. I wrote one suite in my life. It was hard and it was really cool, but I just decided to call it Sweet Tooth. And then I called the whole thing the Complete Suites as a joke. But I think it was hard. I wrote all of this, almost all of this, on my friend's farm in England. I had been spending a lot of time on this farm. A lot of it by myself, you know, in the middle of nowhere in the west of England. I wrote the first suite there. And then a year later, I wrote most of the rest of these songs. And I when I left England, I stopped in London on the way home, and a friend of mine is in a band called Gang of Youths. Mm-hmm. And I had already sung on the record once, but they decided to redo it. So I went and sung on it again. This may have been 2 years later, I'm not sure. I went and sang on it again. And when I got home, Dave, the lead singer, the album got finished a little while after that, and he sent it to me. And in listening to it, it was so good. It's called Angel in Real Time. I still think it's one of the best records anyone's done in the last decade. But it made me realize that the songs weren't good enough. They just weren't quite up to that level. And I don't know why, I've never had this problem before, but I just didn't, they weren't good enough. And I went back and reworked stuff. I rewrote parts of Spaceman in Tulsa. It had too many parts, and I chopped it down to this thing it is now. Under the Aurora was a different song completely. I kept the verses and wrote a whole new chorus for it, which is much better. I finally finished Boxcars. Virginia Through the Rain pretty much stayed the same. And I wrote With Love from A to Z. It's the only time in my life I've really like gotten an awakening like that. Like, I guess I was so excited to finish and do the same thing I had done a year or a couple years before with like doing it all on this farm in isolation, that I was like not as strict with myself as I am. And it wasn't until hearing this, hearing Gang of Youth's record that I realized, oh no, these songs aren't quite good enough. They really, there's a little bit of laziness here. And I need to go back to the drawing board a little bit and work on these. And I did. And it worked. But the weird thing about it was that had kind of really undercut my confidence. And I was very nervous about sending them to the band. It was a real reach on these songs to write stuff that I couldn't necessarily play very well. Especially Spaceman and Aurora has two, like it was impossible to sing until I realized that I could give some of the lyrics to the other guys and spread it out. Boxcars, I could not play. Like I had it in my head, but it was beyond my capability. It was always supposed to be a guitar song, and it was way beyond my capabilities as a piano player to play it. So I couldn't even work on it that way. I had to do it all in my head. It was very difficult. And I was very nervous and insecure feeling, which I normally am not, about sending them to the band, because they were very rudimentary on piano, except for, you know, like Virginia Through the Rain, which is meant to be like it is a piano, very sparse song. But the rest of them, like, I didn't really feel like the versions I could play on the piano represented what they were supposed to be, which I had in my head, you know? And I was really nervous about sending them to the band and having them say they weren't very good, especially after I'd already done it to myself once, you know? And so they sat for like 2 years with just me not being confident in them and not knowing what to do. And wondering whether they were supposed to be a suite or not, but not really feeling like they should be.
Yeah.
And wondering whether I should try and make them flow together anyways, but feeling kind of like rote about, what's the point of that? Just because I did one suite doesn't mean everything has to be a suite, you know? Like, and finally, I got really frustrated with myself and I realized I have to play these to understand them. And so I called up Jim, our drummer, and Millard, our bass player, and Immer, and said, I need you all to come to my house for like a week or two. And we just got to set up a studio in the living room and we play these songs, just like a little sparse drum kit, like whatever, a couple drums, kick and snare. That's all, you know, and a hi-hat, you know, just simple stuff. And I need to play these to know if they're good. And I need you guys to do that because I can't play them. It was cool in a way because I was stretching my capabilities as a writer writing stuff. But I couldn't play them, and I didn't know, and I sat for like 2 years. That's why this record took so long, because I just sat there for 2 years not believing in it. And then when the guys came and we started working on these songs, and one by one they were just killing me. They were so good. They sounded so great. Everyone was really excited. And Boxcars, which I couldn't play at all, I finally had like a musical structure I could finish the writing over. And we were so excited. I'm like, let's just go in the studio right away. Let's do this. And we ended up going in like 2 or 3 weeks later. It was very quick after that. And we made the record, and you know, and or the other half of the record. But it was weird. It's the only time in my life I've ever had that kind of a confidence. I don't know what the word is, like a loss of confidence. But I mean, it was good at first because they did need more work, and I made them much better. The work I did and writing, like finishing Boxcars and writing with Love from A to Z, defines the record in a lot of ways. The work I did rewriting, but the act of sort of doing that kind of shattered my confidence in the songs in a way. You know, it's a new experience for me. I've never had that happen.
Well, look, first, again, thanks for that journey through that. And it's amazing that you were going through that experience for quite some time. And then the band came together. And like you said, then by the time you started recording it, it went really quickly. And that's going to be, so your album, the new album, Butter Miracle, The Complete Sweets, is going to be coming out very soon. You have the tour where you're going to be touring. And I look forward to seeing you guys on tour. That will be cool again. And then I just want to finish up. I want to ask you, with all the experiences, this is a tough one. With all the experiences that you've had, is there anything in your that sticks out to you as an artist? It could be a big experience, small, whatever it is. Is there anything that sticks out as like a very special moment that sticks with you?
I don't know if it's specific moments, but there is so much magic being in a recording studio. And like, making music, the way it goes from this formless idea, a concept of chords, just chords and words, you know, that's all they are, these songs I write, they're just chords and words. The thing you hear is this thing that happens when we all get there together, and all of a sudden it's like, it's a song, and it's a rock and roll song, it's music, it's like, it's powerful, there's this synchronicity of 5, 6, 7 of us, whatever it is, you know, just in a room that takes the barest idea and makes it into this full emotional experience that I think is so fucking cool. Like, it's really not the stuff I do alone, you know, with occasional moments like writing Long December, that's just like, whoa, you know, where I remember it because it's so powerful as a thing on its own, you know. But for most of it, and I wish people understood this more, because to a lot of people, our band is just me, you know? But all I really do is make these skeletons. You know, they're just ideas and concepts with chords and words. That's it. They're not like, it's literally a piece of paper that says A flat, E flat, D flat, whatever, you know, and back to A flat, and, you know, and I don't know what that is. It's, I don't know. That's not around here or something. You know, it's just, what I mean? It's just, and then it's got some things that rhyme.
People are going to be trying that out now at home. They're going to be trying out those chords.
The fact that the guys, not just them, but all of us together, that me and Immer and Jim and Millard, you know, that we and Dave, Dan, that we like, that we can get in a room together and take that skeleton and make it magic, you know, and make it into this. The fact that they understand what I mean, what I'm feeling, all the things that are in me that I'm trying my best to express in this skeleton on paper, you know, and that they can make it into a fully fleshed out thing, that they understand without me even telling them half the time, like just what it means. That's why I love being in a band. Like, it's such a weird thing, music, this like the jazz of the connection between people, the improvisational jazz, the raw magical connection between people that makes music, you know, that takes the difference between what's on a sheet. Because, you know, in the past they used to write sheet music, and every they were smart enough to do it where every musician had his music right in front of him and knew what he was supposed to play. It's not like they're not doing it off the top of their heads. They could see it because the composer had arranged it for them, so they just showed up. And we don't have that. We just have a bunch of guys that get in and look at a piece of paper I've brought them, you know? And then we just do it. And somehow all this separate becomes one, you know, and makes a fucking song in a way that is, I find that so incredible. I love playing live because it's the same thing you're doing when you play live. If you're not just like doing it by rote every night, you know, you're expressing yourself, and you can improvise on stage in a lot of different ways, but nothing approaches the way you did it that first time. Like when you're in the studio and you're just trying to make something that will last forever, you know, that is timeless and endless in that way. And somehow it ends up just being take six, you know, just take six. Or I don't know why I remember this, but in the case of Mrs. Potter's Lullaby, take four, you know, that we did some overdubs, but the whole thing's based on take four, you know, like somehow there's a moment where all of you just come together and make something out of nothing, you know, which is the province of gods, really, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who else creates, you know, like. Art does. Art makes something out of nothing. It is why it is the closest, I think, we come to like divinity in some ways, because
100%, 100%.
Art is the other thing in life that makes something out of nothing. You know, it's just somebody's idea given birth to something timeless. You know, like a song, a painting. You know, we're well paid. Guys like Van Gogh never sold a painting in their lifetime. Neither did Seurat, you know, and they made these things that are just, it's been hundreds of years and we're still staring at them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Look, what you just described, Adam, is exactly why I do this, because I do this for the love of music. That's the story behind the song. It's to hear the story of from the first moment and then what happens, the journey along the way. And then the resonance and the fact that they're timeless and they continue on, the power of it. And the other thing that I think is, it's something that I've always thought about. If I were a musician, I just never had the talent. I love music deeply, deeply. But I always thought that what you said, like the paper having the different chords and the lyrics, and if you give that same paper and the lyrics to 10 different bands or 100 different bands or artists, they're going to come up with something very, very unique to them. And I think that would be such a fascinating thing to see what happens when they haven't heard somebody else's version of it, where they just create it. Because every song can go an infinite number of ways. So that it's pretty fascinating to hear the journeys that you laid out.
You know, that's why I really loved making Underwater Sunshine, in that it was all covers, because it was... It had occurred to me right around that time that it seemed like a waste to spend your entire artistic career only interpreting one person's work, even if that person is myself, because there's so many people doing the work and there's so many different perspectives on how to make a song, and how great would it be just to play some of those other people's songs and to find our own way into those songs. And it was such an incredibly satisfying experience making that record. And I enjoyed it so much, and I was so proud of how it turned out, that I actually thought, man, I could do this. I could do this a bunch. I would love to make a lot of records like this where they're not my songs. You know, and the, part of the problem is that, like, there's a real prejudice toward... It's funny, because until Dylan came along, really, most people didn't write their songs. Even the Beatles and the Stones didn't start out writing their songs. They did a lot of Chuck Berry tunes. I guess Chuck Berry wrote songs. But before that, it was just like Dylan and Chuck Berry, like, and I guess a little bit of Buddy Holly, you know. But I mean, it was, nowadays there's such a prejudice towards like the songwriter being everything. And I guess as a songwriter who really thinks it's not everything, it was so satisfying to explore other songwriters with the band and to like look at different people's perspectives and see how those guys that I work with every day would interpret that stuff. And I really loved it. But I realize we can't do it very much, because the truth is people don't want it. It's like really, we could, but there was such a, it's not a negative reaction, but it's almost a dismissive reaction to making that record. Everyone dismissed it. I've heard people count the number of records we've made and leave it out because it doesn't count. And I'm like, you know what I mean? Yeah. But to me, it's like, that's a shame. Especially because there's this huge pop world where clearly nobody's writing any of their songs. Yeah. And they like allow it there, or they make this pantomime of being a writer along with you know, nine other writers.
Right, exactly.
You know, and I mean, that's fine. Why not? They don't have to write their own songs. I don't think Diana Ross wrote very many songs, and the Supremes are fucking great.
That was Adam Duritz of Counting Crows sharing his story behind his now iconic nostalgic track, A Long December, a song that makes a sing-along nearly 30 years later. Check out the band's new album, Butter Miracle, The Complete Sweets, and catch them on tour all summer and fall. I'm your host, Peter Chadi at Deep Cuts Media. You can find me at deepcutsmedia.com. Check out all of the cool things that we do. And if you like my show, please rate it, follow it, and share it with your friends, family, and other music fans like you. New and classic episodes come to you every Monday morning. And make sure to check out all the cool The Story Behind the Song merch, including the poster and puzzle I have in my studio in the Consequence merch store at shop.consequence.net. Be sure to click on the new release tab to find all that great stuff. And follow the Consequence Podcast Network to keep up to date with all our series at consequence.net/consequence-podcast-network. And as always, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.